from the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC. This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, he left the L.A. Phil to concentrate on composing, but now one of the town's best-known conductors is taking over the San Francisco Symphony. Then for Josie Rourke, directing the movie Mary, Queen of Scots meant revisiting major themes from her work in theater.
What I've been trying to do for my entire career as a theater director before I moved into movies was really to try and tell stories about politics and power and women and sex and sexuality. Like, those are the big themes of my work.
And two generations of African-American harpists talk about their musical traditions, all that on today's Frame.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott, for consideration in all categories.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. The San Francisco Symphony has a new conductor. See if you can guess who it is. That piece, Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, was one of Esa-Pekka Salonen's favorites when he was music director at the L.A. Phil. He handed the baton over to Gustavo Dudamel in 2009, and Salonen has since been guest conducting and composing. But now Salonen is headed back to lead a top orchestra. He's replacing longtime music director Michael Tilson Thomas at the San Francisco Symphony, and the word is he plans to take advantage of its proximity to Silicon Valley. To find out more, I spoke with Joshua Kosman. He's the classical music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. And I started by asking him how the symphony decided on Salonen.
My assumption is that they were looking for someone who could follow in the work that Michael Tilson Thomas has done here over 25 years as music director and kind of take the next step towards the future of what classical music and the orchestra world is going to be in the coming years. Now, what that might have meant, I think, had a lot to do with who they ended up choosing. And I know they had a number of good candidates that might have taken the job, but it sounds from everything I've been told as though interest converged pretty quickly on Esa-Pekka Salonen.
People in Los Angeles are very familiar with Esa-Pekka's work, both conducting and composing. And it sounds like he had really been focusing on the latter since he left the L.A. Phil in 2009.
Well, that's exactly why this appointment has come as such a stunning surprise for everyone in the music business, because he's always said quite resolutely and pretty convincingly, thanks, but no thanks. He said he wasn't interested in taking an orchestra job on a permanent basis because, for one thing, he wanted to have more time for composing. And it wasn't clear at all that there was another orchestra music director job in his future. He has said in the past that he likes to keep the balance around 50-50 between conducting and composing. I asked him, you know, how he was going to make that happen with a job as a music director in a major orchestra, and he said basically, you know, it's a matter of scheduling things so that they don't get on top of one another. And I think also it's going to mean, unfortunately for other folks, less guest conducting elsewhere.
When you talked to him, what were the things that he was most excited about in coming to San Francisco?
Well, there were several. One, of course, is just that he's had great experiences with this orchestra. He's conducted the orchestra three times in the past, and he said they always have had a wonderful time making music together. But I think the main thing was the sense that he wants to be part of an exploratory and sort of forward-looking stage in his career and in the career of an orchestra, and find an orchestra that will help explore new directions for what classical music and what orchestra concerts can be. He's announced that he's bringing in a bunch of artistic collaborators, young musicians and artists and roboticists even, and scientists and AI people who have an interest in sort of expanding the boundaries of the traditional orchestral concert experience.
That, to me, is really a fascinating piece of this equation. San Francisco is obviously situated at the intersection between old and new. It's in close proximity to Silicon Valley, and Salonen is something of a tech geek. How might the city itself be a good setting for the next chapter in Salonen's life, given his interest in technology and what he's already discussing about robotics and orchestral music?
Well, you put your finger right on it. This is a hotbed of innovation. It's a sort of a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true. And a lot of the ideas that are coming out of the tech world now kind of have yet to find their place in the world of orchestral music, certainly in a more conservative setting. But both Salonen and the orchestra have expressed a desire to kind of figure out how that can work together.
I want to play a little bit of music that Salonen has composed. This piece is called Insomnia. Not exactly Mozart, so how are audiences going to, do you think, have to be prepared for Salonen's music, which is definitely, in some cases, pretty avant-garde?
It is avant-garde, but it's not really that daunting, considering the kinds of music that people are open to in other fields now. And I think he has made the interesting point somewhere that for people who aren't steeped in music of Mozart or Beethoven or Haydn, a lot of times new music can be a better avenue in, and it's a way to bring people in who may not be interested in hearing Beethoven's Fifth.
The challenge for any long-standing arts organization, especially one with a season ticket subscriber base, is to make sure that while you're changing, you're not changing too fast to scare away some people. Michael Tilson Thomas was director of the San Francisco Symphony for 25 years. How might he have set the stage for the next chapter in the symphony's history?
The legacy of Michael Tilson Thomas is a really rich one for this orchestra. It's been one of the most important and influential chapters in the orchestra's 107-year history. He's made the orchestra into a great performing ensemble, not only in the standard repertoire and in Mahler and Stravinsky and other kinds of things, but also for new music. So he really has prepared an orchestra that is ready to be handed off to a new music director with excellence on every front, technically in terms of their execution of all kinds of music and in also the spirit of adventure that I know Esa-Pekka is famous for.
Joshua Kosman is the classical music critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Joshua, thanks so much for taking the time to come on the show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Up next on The Frame, Josie Rourke, the director of the new Saoirse Ronan Margot Robbie movie, reconsiders history in Mary Queen of Scots.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the emotionally authentic A Star is Born, directed by Bradley Cooper, starring Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott. Joe Morgenstern of The Wall Street Journal says it's fresh from thunderous start to exquisite finish, and Owen Gleiberman of Variety calls it an emotional knockout. For consideration in all categories, including Best Picture and Best Director.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. It's hard to watch the new film, Mary Queen of Scots, without thinking of recent political events, the 2016 election and the Brett Kavanaugh hearings in particular. And that's because despite being about a moment in British history more than 400 years ago, the film plays like a modern political thriller, where gender, power, and sex are center stage and capable women are dominated by scheming men. In the film, Saoirse Ronan plays Mary, the Scottish queen who was married three times, twice widowed, accused of conspiring to kill her second husband, and branded promiscuous. Margot Robbie plays her cousin, England's Queen Elizabeth. The women are pitted against each other, mostly by their male counsels, to a tragic end. Mary Queen of Scots is directed by Josie Rourke, who is making her filmmaking debut. She's a theater director and the artistic director of the Donmar Warehouse in London. When Rourke and I spoke this week, I asked her how historians have traditionally viewed Mary Queen of Scots.
Well, I'm going to start with probably a big word for NPR, which is I think she's generally slut-shamed by history. So there's a sense that she was too sexually voracious or romantically willful to have been a decent politician. And I kind of say it depends if you know London when I make this reference, but one of the things I really wanted to do was kind of take Mary Queen of Scots out of the Tate Britain, which is where all our old Victorian paintings and our Pre-Raphaelites sit, and try and put her into the Tate Modern and think of her not only actually as a modern figure, but also using this terrific book that John Guy wrote, which is The True Life of Mary Queen of Scots. What he did was he went back into the archives and really did a piece of forensic history into Mary. And what John discovered is that there was really a kind of big besmirching movement. I guess if you were being sort of poppy, you'd call it a kind of fake news movement that was led by William Cecil, who is in the movie, who's played by Guy Pearce, who was completely obsessed with the idea that he not only needed to rid the island of Mary, but also make sure that she went down in history as sexually wild and professionally incompetent. So he started ripping letters out of the archive, had his aides rearrange stuff. He arranged for a pamphlet to be published and circulated around London, saying that she was this femme fatale who murdered her husband Darnley in order that she could marry Bothwell. So it's a very troubled and rather confused history, I think, that sits around her, which is either a combination, as I say, of someone who's being slut-shamed, or almost the other end of that is a kind of gigantic sentimentalization of her as a tragic figure, which I think is also not totally valid.
What was important to you about Mary and her life? What was the corrective story that you and your lead actress, Saoirse Ronan, wanted to tell?
So I think that Mary's choices of partner were actually as much political as they were personal and romantic. So it was incredibly, on one level, smart for her to choose Darnley as her second husband, because that utterly solidified her claim to the English throne. I think in the case of Bothwell, her third husband, I don't subscribe to the view, nor does Saoirse. I think that as a little girl, she was always in love with this romantic protector figure, and once her husband was killed, and she may or may not have been implicated in that, some people think she was this femme fatale. I don't. She was able to rush into the arms of her long beloved. I think that's a kind of nonsense, you know. The minute Darnley was killed, her Privy Council decreed the Parliament that she must marry a Scottishman pretty much the next day. So there was deep tectonic political stuff going on that I think sometimes people write women's sexuality and romantic lives so large that we can miss the nuance of that political detail. So that was something we were really keen just to both explore and set in place.
Saoirse Ronan isn't the only woman in your cast. Margot Robbie plays Elizabeth.
We serve you fully, with all our hearts. Any one of us would gladly die for you, but Mary is our foe and a Catholic.
She is only your queen if I should not produce an heir.
And will you, madam? For you have given us little hope so far.
Despite your every effort, she has prevailed.
She has proven herself, in fact, far more capable than my own Privy Council. Should I die before my time, we could do worse than to place her on the throne of England.
Spoiler, doesn't happen. There's a lot going on in this scene. Why is this scene important to you, and what do you think it sets up in your story?
So what Margot Robbie, who plays Elizabeth brilliantly, by the way, would say is that every single scene for her began with Elizabeth's thought about Mary. And there is some sense in which this movie is in part the role that Mary plays in the creation myth of Elizabeth. What you have in Margot's Elizabeth is someone who is only 3 years into her reign, who is much more cautious, who is correctly paranoid that people are trying to depose her, not only Mary, but forces all around her, and who, unlike Mary, actually leans much more heavily into her advisers, and particularly William Cecil, played by Guy Pearce, and listens to them, takes their counsel, and allows them to shape her judgment. What's great about the scene you just heard, and for me, in some sense, this is the high point of the film for both of those women, is this is almost for me the kind of high point of what I think of as the counterfactual that runs as a sort of silvery thread through the film. So if there is hope in a film, which cannot be very hopeful because in the end they do, I'm afraid, second spoiler alert, chop Mary's head off, there is a sense that this sisterhood that exists between them and their ability to derive confidence from each other is probably at its high point in that scene you just heard, because what you have is Elizabeth really for the first time turning on her Privy Council, defying their advice, questioning their judgment. And so I think what you see is Elizabeth beginning to take a confidence in her own autonomy from Mary's actions.
We're talking with Josie Rourke, who's the director of the new movie, Mary, Queen of Scots. Your screenwriter is Bo Willimon. He's probably known to most people here for his work on the Netflix series House of Cards. But I would cite something else that he did. That's his stage play, Farragut North, which was turned into the movie Ides of March. Bo has a great talent of understanding political infighting and the schemes that people employ to get what they want politically. What were your conversations with Bo about in terms of what you wanted out of the adaptation?
I think what Bo would say about his work, and this I think is very true, although, you know, he has a prismatically brilliant mind, so he's capable of both understanding and turning intrigue, political intrigue, until it hits the light. But what he has always done is begun with character. And I think what Farragut shows, and that's probably amplified to an extent in his seasons of House of Cards, is really the cost of power and its corrosive effect and what that does to the individual and how that plays upon the self and other relationships. And that's a big theme of this movie that we've made, I think. So a lot of our early conversations were about how, in some sense, we could think about the present through thinking about some of really the heavy price that Mary and Elizabeth are either forced to or choose to pay for their reign in their respective countries.
There is so much misogyny and religious prejudice that is directed at Mary. And as you are making this movie, very similar things are happening around the world and certainly in the United States. As you are working on this story that unfolded more than 400 years ago, is history almost repeating itself in front of your eyes in real time as you're working on the movie?
Yeah, it's a good observation. I mean, what I've been trying to do for my entire career as a theatre director before I moved into movies was really to try and tell stories about politics and power and women and sex and sexuality. Like, those are the big themes of my work. And I feel that, you know, the work that I've been making for 15 years in the theatre is moving through a moment where those are the things that we're choosing to be interested in. Has it always been, for the past 500 years, really difficult for women to lead? Yeah. Has the workplace been an incredibly tough environment? Almost definitely. Has there been the sense of womanhood being forced into either a kind of virgin whore dichotomy? Indisputably. And, you know, the Victorians reinforce that. I've always been telling those kind of stories in my work. I think it's probably that what's happened over the course of the past 12 months, for various reasons, is that the gaze has shifted and it has intensified. And it's become something that's important to perhaps a wider group of people. So really, that's the context in which I think this film has come to happen. And does it resonate? Yes. And I think that it's one's responsibility as an artist, whenever you look at any version of the past, to try and tell that through the lens of the present. You know, I've directed a ton of Shakespeare plays, and I wouldn't touch a Shakespeare play if I didn't think it had something to speak directly into the present day. That's a kind of quality of my work, I think.
Josie Rourke is the director of Mary, Queen of Scots. Josie, thanks so much for coming on the show.
It's a joy to talk to you. Thanks for your excellent questions.
Mary, Queen of Scots opens in select theaters on December 7th. Coming up, two generations of African-American harpists talk about their musical traditions. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. 50 years ago, an African-American jazz harpist named Dorothy Ashby recorded an album called Afro Harping. Although not commercially successful, the album became a cult classic in hip-hop circles after being sampled by J. Dilla, Pete Rock, Madlib, and many others. Ashby died in 1986, but her legacy continues today with harpist Brandy Younger. Younger, who's collaborated with the likes of Moses Sumney, Lauryn Hill, and Pharoah Sanders, recorded a number of Ashby's compositions on her most recent album titled Wax and Wane. Younger is based in New York, but was in town recently to visit a friend and retired harpist, Sarah Lawrence, and they spoke with the Frame's producer, Jonathan Shiflett, about how Dorothy Ashby's harp found its way to Altadena, California.
My name is Brandy Younger, and I'm a harpist based in New York.
I'm Sarah Lawrence, living in Altadena, originally from Hempstead, Long Island, New York. And I'm a retired harpist, educator, and administrator.
A concert harp has 47 strings. They're mostly strung with gut. And you've got thousands and thousands of pounds of tension on these strings. So while people think all we do is brrrring, a lot of times people don't know that we actually play notes. The most common comment is, don't you wish you played the flute all the time? And, you know, it's like, well, we get more work than flute players.
And plus, people always want to help you move it. And I don't want any help. And years ago when I started, back in late 40s, my brother and my father would have to carry the harp. They didn't have the dollies or the conveniences that they have now. My parents just bought a harp. One day, there it was, and I used to sit in a high chair to play it because I started when I was 4 and a half.
Ah.
My first song that I learned was Hot Cross Buns, one hand. And as I said, I couldn't reach the pedals, so for years I just had this high chair, which I kept for a long time.
Can you give some history on how we know each other, you and me?
Oh, okay. Her grandmother lived in my mother's house back in the 40s. And my mother had a large house, and she had roomers and boarders. And her grandmother was there. And I didn't know this, but my brother was the ring bearer at her grandmother's wedding. And as time passed and Brandy started playing the harp, her mother talked about me, which I didn't know.
Not just my mom was talking about her. Everyone was talking about her. Where I grew up, they were like, oh, do you know Sarah Lawrence? I used to know a black harpist. Her name was Sarah Lawrence. Like, growing up for years, everyone talked about Sarah Lawrence. And then the whole connection with my grandmother is just insane. It's serendipity. Well,
God arranges all of that. I mean, yeah.
Seriously. And then once we met and then you let me know that you had Dorothy Ashby's harp, I was like, OMG.
So Brandy and I then started to communicate and have contact. I don't remember what she played for me first, but I do remember requesting that she play. I played Ravel's Introduction and Allegro for my senior recital. So I did ask her to play that. Which she did.
I did?
Yeah, on Dorothy Ashby's harp, right here in this dining room.
Wow.
And I'm thrilled because Brandy's in my will and trust. And now I have someone to leave my harps to. So I had my two harps restored, and now I can leave them to Brandy.
You just put that out there and like,
well,
there.
It's written, and I just read my will and trust, and it's written, along with my music chest and my harp ring and anything else that she might want to have.
If it's magic, then why can't it be everlasting?
To give a little background on Dorothy Ashby, she was from Detroit. She recorded 11 albums as a leader. A lot of people don't know that, you know.
I didn't know that.
A lot of people know If It's Magic by Stevie Wonder, and that's it. And then the people that dig a little deeper, they know Afro-harping. And then people that are into old school hip-hop, they really know Afro-harping because Pete Rock sampled a lot of it, Madlib, and J. Dilla, they sampled a lot of her stuff. she had a nice product. And it's not easy being a, you know, a female in jazz, and then you play the harp. And what that
and
had...
being an African-American.
At that. So she... And this was around the 50s.
She was ahead of her time.
Way ahead of her
way
time.
Way ahead, yeah.
She literally was not hampered by other people's...
opinions.
Opinions and expectations. She was such an incredible musician and decided to play what she wanted to play, how she wanted to play it, unapologetically. Oh, yeah. This is Dorothy Ashby's Lyon and Healy Style 100. Very out of tune, but a very beautiful tone, missing some strings.
And it's serendipity, the way I received it. I was standing on Adams in Los Angeles waiting to go into one of the churches, and a gentleman saw me standing there and had her harp, and it needed some strings. And he drove by, came back, and said, I have a harp, I need some strings put in. Do you know how to do that? And I said, yes. And he said, well, can I pay you if you'll come over and replace the strings for me?
Looks like it just came out of the shop. Well, kind of did.
Well, it did.
It kind of did, yeah.
Yeah, that's been a blessing, and I'm really glad to know that my harp will be in good hands.
Those were harpists Brandy Younger and Sarah Lawrence. And that is The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow.